Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Governing to Win, exploring ideas to enhancing national competitiveness. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. The IBM Center for the Business of Government recently published Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches, edited by Chuck Proh, which brings together insightful ideas by leading thinkers and practitioners that offer a long-term strategy to improve national competitiveness. What is national competitiveness? How can our nation better compete in today's global economy? What's driving the annual federal deficit? And how is governance the new competitiveness imperative? Today, we will explore these questions and so much more with my guests, Larry Haas and Gail Fossler. First up, I'd like to welcome Larry Haas, contributor to the recent IBM Center book, Governing to Win, and author of his recent book, Sound the Trumpets. Welcome, Larry. It's great to have you on the program.
Nice to be here.
So, Larry, I've asked every one of our contributors to the book, Governing to Win, what is national competitiveness?
Well, of course, the root is competition or compete, and it really has to do with a country's place in the world. And to the extent that you want to improve U.S. competitiveness in this case, you need to create the right economic environment. You need to have the right monetary policy, regulatory policy, fiscal policy. So you want the Fed to be handling monetary policy correctly, and you want policymakers not to be overregulating, not to be overtaxing, and on the spending side, to be investing in the kinds of things that grow an economy. That has to do with hard things like infrastructure, roads, bridges, internet, so that businesses can be competitive. And on the human capital side, it has a lot to do with education. You want to make sure that you've got a workforce that's well-educated and skilled so that they are ready for the increasingly sophisticated jobs of the future. So in essence, what you're doing, to the extent that you have a competitive nation, you have followed and created the policies that put your businesses and your people in a position to win in an increasingly competitive global environment. That's what competitiveness is.
So, Larry, at first blush, the problem of a growing federal deficit seems straightforward to fix. The government is spending more than it is collecting in revenue, and policymakers need to close this gap. But you point out in your piece that it's far more complex than that. Could you elaborate on what composes this complex reality?
Sure. You know, I give a lot of speeches about the budget, and I often get the question very much in the way that you posed it. Well, what's the problem here? We're just spending too much. Let's just cut spending. And people seem to have this sense that the budget has a category which is called spending, just spending writ large. It's this kind of metaphysical thing. But the budget, of course, isn't just spending. It's real things for real people. They're there for a reason. We either want them or we need them. When you look at the budget, think about what dominates the budget. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, national security, homeland security, border safety, environmental protection, aid to education, housing, transportation, science, space, all of those things were put in the budget to serve a certain purpose. They all have support for major sectors of the American population, so that when you sort of say, well, why don't we just cut spending? The reason we can't just cut spending, the reason it's not that easy, is that people have an interest. They have a personal interest in what is currently part of the budget. And when you try to cut it, people howl. And to the extent that the program is ever more popular, they howl ever louder. And it makes it hard to cut spending.
You point out in your piece that you can't solve the problem by simply cutting waste, fraud, and abuse.
Right.
The problem is simply too big, as you point out. Tough decisions are demanded. Would you tell us more about what those decisions would look like? What are the implications of making such decisions, and how do they relate to what government should do and what it needs to pay for?
Well, first, we should talk a little bit about this issue of waste, fraud, and abuse, because it is something that people focus on quite a bit. Why can't we just eliminate all the waste from government. Why don't we stop paying members of Congress so much, get rid of their limousines, and stop providing foreign aid overseas? The average person, according to polls, believes that foreign aid is approximately 25% of the federal budget. In reality, it's less than one-half of 1% of the federal budget. Congressional salaries, limousines, things like that are an infinitesimally small piece of the federal budget. Once again, as I said before, the federal budget is real things for real people. So to the extent that you're going to make a serious effort to balance the budget, it means that tens of millions of Americans are going to have to accept less or pay more in taxes or some combination of the two. And if you look at the major programs of government, we're talking about lots of people who get lots from government. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, aid to education, as I mentioned before, national security, homeland security. Think about all the people who benefit from those programs. That's why it's harder than just this issue of cutting waste, fraud, and abuse. Should we cut all the waste out of government that we possibly can? Absolutely. Are people working every day to do that? Sure. Every department and agency has an auditor, has an inspector general, and they're looking to cut waste. But unfortunately, this problem is so big. There is such a gap. There is such a large budget deficit today and larger deficits as we look into the future that we simply can't fiddle around the edges and just cut waste and hope to solve this problem. It's much bigger than that. It's about cutting real things and it's about people paying more in taxes.
What's interesting, Larry, is in your piece you acknowledge that federal deficits are nothing new in America, but the cause, size, and frequency have changed dramatically in recent decades. Would you elaborate on this change, and what are the implications of this new condition?
Well, you know, for most of American history, the federal government ran budget deficits for one of only two reasons. Either the country was at war, so it had to spend a lot more for the military to actually fight the war, or the country was in either a recession or depression, and actually depressions tended to be a lot more common in the 19th century than they are today. And during a recession or a depression, the government suffers quite a bit by a lack of tax revenue because individuals and corporations are not doing as well as they otherwise would be. But, you know, from the beginning of the Republic, 1789, up through the early 1930s, so that's most of American history, after the war was over or the economy had recovered, the government ran surpluses to pay off the debt that had accumulated in the previous period. And in fact, if you look at the early stage of American history, keep in mind, we ran surpluses twice as often as we ran deficits. That changed in the early 1930s. Now we've got deficits that are much more frequent. We have deficits that occur almost every year these days, ever since the 1930s. And we don't run them only because we're at war or because we're in recession. We run them because we want more from our government than we're willing to pay for. And that is a real cultural change. We have become accustomed to deficits. And when you become accustomed to them, they're a lot harder to address than when you assume, as we did up until the early 1930s, that they were a bad thing and we need to eliminate them as soon as possible.
Well, you, the Depression, you point out in your piece, brought two landmark changes to federal budget making. Would you describe them for us?
Sure. And they have to do with what we were just discussing a moment ago by way of cultural change. First, with the collapse of the economy starting in 1929 and lasting all through the 1930s, people in a new way looked to Washington as the place to address their hardship. Until the Great Depression of the late 20s and early 30s, when the country was in a time of recession or depression, people looked to their local government. They looked to their county government. They looked to their state government. Only after that did they look to their federal government. Starting in the 1930s, first with Hoover and then with Roosevelt, people looked to Washington as the place to solve this problem. That's number one. Number two, there was a change in economic doctrine. For most of the country's history, it was taken as a given that balanced budgets under all circumstances were the right way to go. The balanced budget was the key to economic growth. And starting in the 1930s with the onset of Keynesian economics, a new philosophy took root and actually dominated the economics profession for quite a number of decades, which was that in times of hardship, such as the Great Depression, it is not only appropriate, but it is beneficial for the government to run deficits as a way to cushion the blow of the Depression and to move us back to recovery. And that's where we saw the onset of frequent and more acceptable deficits.
I'd like to turn to the idea of power and culture, and in particular, to what extent does power in Washington derive from the size of the budget that you oversee? What are the dangers of such a reality, and what could be done to change this condition?
Well, it is the case that power derives largely from the size of the budget that you oversee, and it plays out on different levels in Washington. It plays out at the executive level with regard to cabinet departments and agencies. Presidents ever since at least Richard Nixon in the 1960s have all come to Washington saying that the federal government's too big, it's doing too many things, we've got to sort out these responsibilities, and we've got to devolve power back to the states and localities. And every single one of those presidents, conservative, liberal, Republican, Democrat alike, has grown the federal government. They've grown the size of the cabinet. Cabinet has grown in a big way. We used to have cabinet meetings largely in the cabinet room of the White House. When the president wants to have a cabinet meeting now, he's far more likely to have it in the Roosevelt room, which is next door, because the table's bigger, the chairs are smaller, and you can fit the cabinet around the table. You can't really fit the cabinet around the cabinet table in the cabinet room of the White House anymore. You've got to go into the Roosevelt room. So it's really quite symbolic of how big government has gotten. Now, again, president comes to town, says he's going to reduce the size of government. Those cabinet members, they don't really have any interest in cutting their own budgets, because to the extent that they cut their budget, they've got less power. If they grow their budget, all else being equal, they've got more power. The same for the committees on Capitol Hill that oversee those departments. Why does every member of Congress want to be on the Appropriations Committee? Because it oversees more spending. If they can't get on appropriations, where else do they want to be? In the House, they want to be on the House Ways and Means Committee. It oversees the entire tax code and quite a bit of the human resource side of the spending component of the budget. So it plays out on Capitol Hill, it plays out in the executive branch, and frankly, it plays out in the private sector with interest groups that come to Washington and try to protect and grow what they have. In Washington, on K Street, on L Street, on Pennsylvania Avenue, around Capitol Hill, we've got one 12-story building after the other, all populated by the National Association of something. Teachers, farmers, big business, small business, and they're there for a reason. They're there to grow what it is they're getting from the government, a spending subsidy, a tax break. So everything is, in essence, incentivized towards yes and more. Yes, I want more of what I'm already getting. If you're a cabinet member, if you're the chairman of a congressional committee, if you're the head of an interest group. So power does derive from the size of your budget. And the reason it's dangerous is because it makes it very difficult to align the taxes we pay with the spending we want. We don't want to pay taxes, but because of all these forces, we want more and more spending. So it's no great surprise that we've got a greater frequency of deficits and deficits that are larger than they've ever been before.
Larry, you've done a wonderful job setting up your piece, but I'd like to know a little bit more about you. Could you tell us a little bit more about yourself, and how did you come to contribute to the new book, Governing to Win?
Well, I've been involved in federal budgeting in some way for more than 25 years. I started in Washington as a journalist, wrote most prominently for National Journal magazine, which is a prominent politics and policy magazine in Washington. I was there for 5 years covering budget and tax issues. After a short stint as a freelance writer, I went into the Clinton administration. I was the communications director at the Office of Management and Budget for 3.5 years, and then the communications director for Vice President Gore for a year. But when I was at OMB, of course, I was living the budget every single day. And then after I left the administration, I continued to be active on budget issues. I've written books and articles on budgeting. And so it's no surprise when the good folks at IBM were putting together this book and were looking for authors that they called on me. I know some of these people personally. We worked together in the White House. I respect them. They respect me. They came to me. They asked me to write the chapter. I wasn't shocked when they called.
What's driving the annual federal deficit and how are entitlements taking over? We will explore these questions and much more when the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, Governing to Win, returns.